You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Molly O'Neill has written a number of best-selling cookbooks, including The New York Cookbook, A Well-Seasoned Appetite, and The Pleasure of Your Company. She reviewed restaurants for Newsday and was a food columnist for The New York Times, both in the Wednesday food section and the Sunday magazine. So I think it's fair to say she knows a thing or two about food writing. And she has drawn upon that expertise for the latest in a series from the Library of America. It's called American Food Writing, an anthology with classic recipes, and I'm very pleased to welcome her to the show. Hi.
Hi.
Did you intend this book to serve as a kind of a culinary history of the United States?
I guess that's not how we started, but the more we read, the more we realized that we could choose food writing, samples of food writing, and if we put them together, it's a way of telling the story of the United States.
How far back in history were you able to find food-related writing?
With the early explorers. We had work from Henry Hudson and then later the Finnish naturalist Peter Kalm, who did some beautiful work when he came. He was sent by his government to look at plant stocks and say what might have a commercial application back home. And he was a fastidious notekeeper, but he also fell in love with the majesty and the diversity of this new country.
Well, it must have been exciting for those people because the Columbian Exchange has really changed the world. The foods from the Americas that went to Europe and Asia and the foods from those continents that came to the United States. You can't imagine French cooking without chocolate or, tomatoes or any of the other things that came from the Americas, and can't imagine American food without all of the things that came from Europe.
But at that time, that exchange was barely beginning. And so there were so many new things that these guys were encountering. They were also encountering culture clashes that, you know, we hadn't seen recently in Europe. And so they're seeing what happens when there's a settlement of Scandinavians and they're exchanging foodstuffs and making trades with the Dutch on their right and the Native Americans on their left, and what happens in between. And some of the writers were intensely Catholic in their approach. If it wasn't old country, then it was savage. And some of them were wonderfully curious. Oh, look at what we found. Look at this wonderful exchange. And there were, there were also some wonderful passages early on showing about the bounty of this country and the very early stages of big business, food business. We have a wonderful passage about oysters and how they were being barreled and shipped back to Europe because we had such a plenty and they were fished out by then in Europe.
New York was probably the greatest repository of oysters at the time.
That's right.
When did people start writing about food as a way of sharing a sensual experience?
There's always been a bit of that, but it became most pronounced after the sexual revolution. Food became a way of broadcasting longing and sensuality and desire.
Which sexual revolution are we talking about? You're saying that nothing like this was done until after the 60s?
No, I'm not saying nothing. It happened previous to the 60s. There has always been a split in American food writing, and it's the exact same split as the American psyche. There are people who really believe in the human organism and the human body and that we were given our senses to enjoy the world. And then there's another camp that believes, oh, no, these are things that we must control in order to be closer to God, in order to be purer people, more directed people, more focused people. And we see that split throughout American history. When you said sensuality, it became pronounced as sensuality after the 60s, but the split is eternal.
Well, many people were coming here as immigrants from places where food was hard for them to get. They were starving, and suddenly they wound up in the land of plenty, and they had to contend with it. But, we still have problems in this country, and I gather that you are involved in a series of cook-offs to find America's best home cooks to raise money to feed the hungry.
That's right. I mean, one of the things that is so impossible to believe is that anybody in this country could be at risk for hunger or go to sleep hungry. And yet it does happen. I mean, in the last several years, I've traveled around the country looking at food banks and meeting people who were going to food banks and trying to understand where is it falling apart. And the great reckoning for me is that it's not the kind of proverbial guy under the bridge. It's often the disenfranchised middle class, and it's often our elderly who are making decisions between buying their groceries and buying their medications. It's a real wake-up call.
You've included writings from people we would expect to see here, MFK Fisher, James Beard, Julia Child, Craig Claiborne, people who pretty much wrote mostly about food. But then there are Meriwether Lewis of Lewis and Clark. There's Nathaniel Hawthorne, Henry David Thoreau, Melville, Whitman, Emily Dickinson. They were obviously not writing about food as foodies, were they?
Not as foodies always. But they were often very observant about food, or they used food to talk about the world. I love the Emily Dickinson black cake recipe in one of the letters that we found when she's encouraging her niece, don't go to church. Go downstairs. Go down into the larder and taste the plums and taste this and have a little piece of that. And I find that the most satisfying way of spending the Sabbath. And it was at such odds with our notion of Emily Dickinson as this kind of Victorian of Amherst with no sensuality, not at all. And yet, because of her life, she focused a lot of it on the food. The Transcendentalists were much more using food to talk about it as one of the basic planks in self-sufficiency, and that we can take this great delight in feeding ourselves, that if we walk out in the morning and can look at the land and say, there's my dinner, you know, there is the salad, there is the fish, there is, and then bring it back, we are independent people. We own our own lives and are not dependent on another. So they came at food. They used food for different ends, but there was always a joy inside. We were looking for joy in these selections.
My guest is Molly O'Neill, who has edited a collection called American Food Writing, an anthology with classic recipes, and it is published by the Library of America and has classic recipes from people like Thomas Jefferson as well. You write about culinary reforms regularly occurring when each new generation rejects some staple of their upbringing. How does that work?
It's very interesting. You know, I, as well as many of my co-generationists, thought that we invented the food revolution and we invented French cooking and American cooking and organic food and all of the conceits that have shaped our lives. But as I was reading through the history of American food writing, it's really clear that this is been a rite of passage for quite a long time. My eureka moment was rereading Mary McCarthy's The Group. And there's a fabulous passage in which one of the girls is saying to the other, oh, have you tried the new iceberg lettuce? It is so crisp. It is so modern. It is so wonderful. It is so much better than that leafy stuff from Mother's Garden. And yet we want the leafy stuff from Mother's Garden.
And look down on the iceberg lettuce, except if you want to put something in a bunch of crisp lettuce as a decoration.
Right, right.
As early as 1820, we see debates about diet. John Pintard, in a series of letters to his daughter, talks about friends of his whom he feels are overindulging in food. He also frowns upon alcohol. So we're seeing the same kinds of debates that we see develop later.
Yeah, there are constant debates in American culture, and that constant push-pull between indulgence and denial. We've seen it from the very earliest food writing in America, and it continues today.
And then we see other kinds of odd changes. He wrote to his daughter about the opening of the Fulton Fish Market on January 22nd, 1822. We could have a piece here about the closing of the Fulton Fish Market.
Maybe we should.
Just last year. So you include a segment that details the beginnings of barbecue in the United States. How did we come to begin barbecuing?
I have no idea, but I loved that essay. It was about an outing, a pastoral outing on one of the Jefferson estates. And we saw that barbecue was a ritual. It was building the entire building of an outdoor dining room, slaying the animal, preparing the pit. It was an all-day affair, and it was meant to take the gentlemen and ladies out to the country and really live there intensely for a day. And I love the way that all of the little rituals were described in that essay and the great effort that went into constructing it. Now, the great unspoken is that the ladies and gentlemen themselves were not doing the work. Slaves were doing the work.
Talking about slaves, Thomas Jefferson, I mentioned, you have a recipe of his for ice cream, although it's not the same ice cream as we would eat today, is it?
It's a custard-based ice cream recipe that he brought back after serving as the ambassador to France. It was a little more arduous to make ice cream since they were not dealing with an electric ice cream maker. They were dealing with ice that had been cut out of the river and stored. And so to be able to get a well chilled ice cream was quite a feat. It's a richer ice cream than we have today, but the recipe works and it's awfully good.
You also include an early version of a recipe for macaroni and cheese presented by the daughter of a signer of the Declaration of Independence. So some things never change. Mac and cheese.
Exactly.
Frederick Douglass is a contributor, but you talked about Jefferson going to France, coming back with French ideas, and that happens continually throughout this book. We have Gertrude Stein, who seems to be mystified with American eating habits after she lived in France.
Mystified, but I think more open-minded than many of her contemporaries. She and Alice found a few things that they could enjoy when they traveled back to the United States. And they really wanted to keep their minds and their taste buds open. They were far less close-minded, far less Catholic, far less reverse imperialist with the French experience.
You also remind us that a restaurant called Le Pavillon was really very important in the development of American tastes and the acceptance of French food. It's been largely forgotten today, but there was a time when Henri Soulet was considered the man, and so many of the people we associate with great French food came out of that kitchen.
It must have been a remarkable place, don't you think? The numbers
of people
who were trained.
I've just looked at the menus and thought, oh, gee, why didn't I go there? And especially when you see some of these bottles of Burgundy for $5, some of the great wines of the time. But things do get forgotten, and suddenly we create new mythologies around our food.
Right.
You also have some pretty new foodies here. We know of Bud Trillin and Anthony Bourdain and Michael Pollan and Ruth Reichel, but I wonder how many people are familiar with Craig Claiborne's $4,000 meal in 1975 and Russell Baker's response to it.
I remember that as being such a big moment, but maybe it's one of the ones that you're referring to that gets forgotten. You know, Claiborne won this meal for two in Paris at a charity auction. He bid on it, and you know, they packed up, and he and Pierre Frenet went and had this extraordinary meal, and he came back and wrote about it. And there was an outrage at the decadence of the meal. And what Baker did was, I mean, Twain could not have done it better. He mocked it and talked about his dinner of frank and beans and his vintage, I think it was Tab or Coca-Cola. And there you have it again. In addition to being pulled between indulging the senses and not indulging the senses, we're pulled between a democratic vision of food in which everyone should be eating the same and a more elitist vision of food in which people distinguish themselves from one another by what they eat. And that's been constant through American history.
Although Joseph Wexberg, in writing about Henri Soulet, the restaurateur responsible for Le Pavillon, tells the story of Soule having them his people stop at a roadside stand on the way back from the Hamptons. He says, let's get out and have a couple of hot dogs. They're delicious here. America is a bit of a democratizer, isn't it?
It really is.
Thank you so much for being with us. Molly O'Neill has edited the American Food Writing, an anthology with classic recipes from the Library of America. You also working for Reader's Digest these days?
Oh, I did a food section for them several years ago.
But that's no longer.
No, I created it and they're running with it.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much for being with us to talk about this book.
Great to be here.
It's going to be a lot of pleasurable reading over the next year or so.
Have a good time with it.